You know, the reason they like reading my stuff is that I've always got real-life examples to prove what I'm saying.
There's a lot of good people that listen to this podcast.
You know, other than God and my family, deer hunting would be next in line on my list of priorities.
From the bottom of our hearts, it's just fantastic and awesome to have the support that you guys are giving.
People ask me about expandable broadheads and love swings.
Chasing Giants with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. Brought to you by Osseo Camo, nature's most lethal camouflage. Follow along as Don and Terry discuss the techniques, strategies, and dedication needed to harvest one of God's most amazing creations, world-class whitetails.
Well, welcome everyone to the Chasing Giants podcast, brought to you by Osseo Gear with Don Higgins and Terry Peer. It's been a week since we've been with you, but boy, do we have a special episode for you today.
Yes, we do. Our good buddy Joe Miles is going to be joining us for a little debate on broadheads here at the end of this podcast, Terry.
So Joe Miles is no stranger to the podcast. He's been on several times with us, not only at the Masterclass, but the Dixie Deer Classic down in North Carolina, and I think he was even on one other time. But he's become a pretty close friend that we both respect very well. The podcast side of our business has brought us and connected to a lot of great people, but Joe Miles being one of those.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Joe's a great guy, and we may never agree on broadheads, but there's going to be a lot of things we do agree on, including politics.
Yeah, so you're gonna want to stay tuned to the end of the podcast today. We're going to air the debate that was between Don and Joe. Like we said last week, neither one of you are ever going to change each other's opinion, but kind of give some more background to the stance behind both of your positions. So that'll play here a little bit later in the podcast episode. We're going to only have two questions because we want to be respectful of the time of the podcast and not make it too long, but great content. Make sure you stay tuned. Let's start with what you got attacked this week as far as food plots and habitat, Don. Did you get any projects done?
No, I got a little fertilizer spread, but that's about it. We got hit by rain, so I'm just itching to get my plots in, and I'm ready. You know, I got a new John Deere 7000 four-row corn planter that I've worked on just a little bit to get it ready to go to the field, but this next week they're calling for fantastic weather. It's currently raining at my house now, but this is the last day of rain, and then for the next 10 days it's not only supposed to be dry, but it's supposed to get a lot warmer, temperatures in the mid to upper 80s most days. So it looks like when we record next time I will have my plots in.
I think the spike in that temperature is vital, not only being sunny but vital to getting that ground temperature up, but the moisture is going to be great, but it's going to dry that top out, allow us to get in the field and the temp of the ground to get up a little bit to where the germination is kicking in. The biggest news for me this week is I finally acquired enough fertilizer and lime for what I needed, and you helped me score some herbicide. You know, the herbicide is really tough to come by, and you were able to pull some strings up there in Illinois and get some pre-emergent both for corn and beans for me. We're going to do a little bit of testing with different residuals this year between all of us folks at Real World, whether we decide we need to continue selling this stuff as a service to our customers or just providing a little bit of insight. We're going to all be using different types of residuals this year.
Yeah, you know, I think as time goes on, a lot of resistant weed issues are popping up around the country. You know, in particular, you've got water hemp and mare's tail that have become real issues in soybean fields. And, you know, a lot of the food plot industry has looked to new technologies. They've tried to get away from like the Roundup Ready, you know, earlier technologies and move on to like the Enlist and dicamba soybeans. But the more I see of that, the more I dislike it, because I believe the deer are not near as attracted to those crops that have different GMO traits stacked. And I think the key is a different chemical program on those grain crops. Instead of just going out and planting your soybeans and then coming back later and spraying over the top of them with Roundup and you're good to go, which worked fantastic for a number of years. Today, I think the key is a residual herbicide put down at the time you plant. And so you and I, and we've got Wes Delks and some others that are helping us test some various residual herbicides. And we want to be able to offer our customers the best advice we can. And the only way we can do that is by, you know, having firsthand knowledge and experience with these different chemicals.
Yeah, just like the products that we sell and market, we're not going to try to sell it or put our name behind it unless we've used it. It's kind of the MO that we've always been around with not only Real World, but this podcast. The thing that really intrigues me the most about pre-emergent herbicide, which is not used a lot down around where I'm at, because we still don't have the issue with mare's tail and water hemp that you guys do further up in the Midwest, is being able to offer a non-GMO product like NutriCrave corn, which we've shown time and time again. I'm not a agronomist or botanist or whatever the scientific term is, but the further we mutate that plant to be kind of tolerant to GMO or to herbicides, the less attraction and less nutrients we probably are putting into that. So we've seen time after time putting a non-GMO product out in the field, the deer hammer it so much more. So I'm really excited to dive into the pre-emergent a little bit more here in Kentucky. We've used it in Illinois a lot, but bringing that to the table here on my home farm, it's just something new that I've never done. I'm going to learn a lot as I go and put a lot of non-GMO stuff out.
Yeah, I think in the ag industry, you know, science has been geared towards higher yields and instead of higher nutrient content. And, you know, I think that those yields came at a price. Without a doubt, you know, today's hybrids are yielding better than they ever have before.
Right.
But the nutrient content a lot of times suffers. And a good example of that is the protein level in corn. Today, it's as low as it's ever been. And if you're planting something different with a higher protein, fat level, whatever, the deer absolutely know it. And they'll walk right through the other stuff to get to it. And, you know, we just continue to test new varieties all the time to find the best.
Yeah. And I think the chemicals are kind of they're scary for the average food plotter. The guys that listen to this podcast and that are Real World customers, that are row crop farmers, it's part of their daily life, almost their commute to work every day, if you will. But you know, the number of questions we get every single week with people with a label on a jug asking if this will work with a product, they're so worried that all that, you know, blood, sweat, tears, work, time away from home, money that their wife may or may not know that they've spent might get trashed because they sprayed the wrong application or the wrong product on it. The average food plotter, I think, just isn't real comfortable with it yet. And I think that if you're going to dive in and learn, the pre-emergent side of this is probably the where you should go more than anything, because it's just going to open up the doors a lot more to especially as chemicals become more expensive and harder to find, possibly being able to keep a better food plot by using them. You know, again, it's like the guys that are into row crop, they have no problem with it all. But the average food plotter, it's way over their head sometimes.
Yeah, you know, Terry, with a good residual, sometimes you don't even have to come back and spray over the top of your plot later.
Right.
And in some cases, you're using very little of it. A good example is the Kyber that we're using on our soybeans this year, using 1 pint per acre. So a 2.5 gallon jug, it's enough to do 20 acres. Right. And, you know, you and I each have a jug of that's going to, you know, serve us for multiple years.
Right.
And yeah, it's expensive. It's, I don't know, it was over $200 a jug. No, it was over $200 a gallon.
Right.
But when you divide that up by the number of acres cost you get
per acre.
It,
yep.
Yeah, it's fairly reasonable.
And Roundup's going up to $60 to $80 a gallon right. Where you're at, and you use a whole lot more Roundup than a pint per acre.
Yep. And then the one that I'm using on the corn this year is Resicor. Scott Finnendahl, our distributor in Wisconsin, turned me on to that. And he said last year when he planted his NutriCrave corn, he put down the Resicor as a pre-emergent and never went back and sprayed at all with anything, and had the cleanest corn that he'd ever seen. So I think it's going to be real critical for us moving forward to do some education pieces to help our customers, you know, pick the right chemicals and control some of these resistant weeds.
Right. And the other thing that I guess kind of to piggyback off of that is we've found that in different areas of the country, you just can't get some products. You know, the Resicor that you just talked about was in very limited supply this year. We couldn't find it. You're using that. I'm going to use Harness Extra on my product down here. I believe that's what we got in it.
Right. Yep.
Is it Harness XL or Harness Extra? I think it's Harness Extra.
Yep.
Just trying to sample some different products because people get have access to different things in different parts of the country. But, you know, I think the food plot industry is going a little bit the wrong direction. You know, they're trying to follow almost the gimmick and the pattern to, you know, somebody's even out there trying to talk about dicamba right now. And it just makes me really cringe because the average food plotter has no business even thinking about using a dicamba product. Those who know ag are probably laughing right now. But you know, some of these chemicals are so volatile that after you spray them, they can actually raise back up off, you know, condense and raise back up as a mist and float off of your property onto somebody else's. And, you know, there's been very talented, skilled farmers that have killed their neighbor's crop because of it. So, I think at the end of the day, this is probably going to be a big part of the education and the takeaways from this upcoming food plot season is how we can use residuals to not only offer products that are more attractive for the deer, more nutrients for the deer, but also safer for the average food plotter to dabble in, because a lot of guys just don't get into it like farmers do.
Right. You know, you mentioned the dicamba soybeans that are being pushed by some folks in the food plot industry, and you may not know it, but in some southern states, it's illegal to spray dicamba after a certain date because cotton is so sensitive to it that, you know, you could spray that and a cotton field a half a mile away gets wiped out as that, you know, drifts. The wind it'll just pick up on the kind of vaporize almost, and the wind will move it. And the first time a food plotter wipes out a neighbor's ag field and has to pay for it, somebody's in trouble in the food plot industry, I feel. So, you know, we're trying to offer the best advice we can. First of all, we want it to be safe. We want it to be easy, and we want it to be the most attractive to the deer. And there's a lot of things in the ag industry that will work and help us do that. But there's also some things in the ag industry that the average food plotter probably needs to stay away from.
Yep. All right. Well, like I said, we have flash floods going on right now. It's raining where you're at, but hopefully next week, both we're in the field working. That's the goal anyway. Yep. We're going to take a quick break and listen to a spot from our primary sponsor, Osseo Gear.
Osseo Gear introduces a premium line of bow hunting gear that is unmatched, pairing nature's finest camouflage with the best technological innovations. Osseo Gear brings whitetail bow hunters the gear they need to be the best at their craft. The unique camouflage mimics the intricate feather pattern of North America's greatest predatorial creatures. Designed for invisibility, built for comfort, and engineered for function. Visit osseogear.com. That's A-S-I-O-Gear.com to start shopping. Osseo Gear, prepare to be invisible.
We're going to play the the debate after the two questions we got from our listeners. So I'm going to throw the first question up and we can start with that here at the beginning of the podcast.
All right. Our first question comes from Ben Sweeney from Waukon, Iowa. Ben says, Don, thanks for all the great information and advice on the smallest details that will make the biggest difference. On episode 115, you had mentioned that over the last few years, a lot of your up-and-comers are getting harvested before they reach their full maturity. Seems like a common thing talking to other deer hunters. With cell cams coming on so strong last few years because of affordability, I'd assume that's the biggest difference maker in success. If you were to set the law on regulations regarding cameras, would you keep them the same or outlaw cell cams during hunting season? Thanks. Let's go, Brandon. Well, Ben, today I picked a couple of questions that are kind of related to hunting ethics because of the debate that Joe and I are going to have later on this episode. And you mentioned cell cams and the fact that, you know, I've stated that I'm losing a lot of my up-and-comer bucks. Personally, I don't think cell cams have anything to do with it, at least in my situation. If anything, I think it's some of the state regulations, in particular, the legalization of crossbows would have a much bigger impact than trail cameras in my area. Your question was, if I was in charge, you know, what would my law be regarding the use of cell cams? And, you know, that's a pretty tough question because, you know, I don't believe it's my place to be pushing my ethics on everyone else. I do think that, you know, as a personality in the hunting industry, if you will, that I should encourage people to think about ethics, but as far, and I should share what my ethics are, but I don't think it's my place. And you're going to hear some of this in the Broadhead debate. It's not my place to say cell cameras should be outlawed. Now you're going to hear me say that I think mechanical broadhead should be outlawed, and that is from a standpoint of, you know, wounded animals. That's why I think they should be outlawed. I think we should strive for quick, humane kills. But when it comes to things like trail cameras, baiting, you know, which is allowed in some states, things like that, I don't think it's my place to be dictating to everyone what they should be doing.
I was talking to
Terry smiling, so I think he's got a comment here.
I was reminded of, while you were saying and talking about that, I was reminded of a conversation I had probably a couple weeks ago with a friend of mine about cell cameras. And the big push, kind of the sales tool that a lot of people are saying that justify getting cell cameras, is keeping intrusion down because they don't have to go in and check the cards. And this guy had an interesting spin. He said, I think it causes more intrusion. And I was like, what do you mean? He said, somebody gets a up-to-date last minute picture of a buck and they go in and try to hunt him immediately and it not be the right conditions. And I was like, wow, I'd never thought of that, because we spend so much time talking about how a cell camera can be used to keep from going in and getting the data, but we don't talk about how people are misusing that up-to-date last information the wrong way, and probably forcing you into making some bad decisions. So, you know, I think that there's sides to both. I think everybody has to make the decision for them as what they want to do. There's different products that are always going to offer different kind of advantages or scenarios that's going to either make you more comfortable or have you more intel or maybe even allow you to stay in the woods longer. But at the end of the day, it's how people use it that's really the thing that makes the difference.
Right. You know, I've said it before. I think for every mature buck that gets killed because of a cell camera, five others are going to get saved because of a cell camera, because the guy that's running it just can't stay out, and he's going to tip that buck off, and he's going to ruin his chances of killing that deer. Whether he has his picture or not, it's irrelevant. It's that human intrusion that camera brings to the woods that's going to save more bucks than the trail camera will ever kill.
Yeah, it's amazing how many, and I don't spend a lot of time on social media much anymore. I post stuff, but I don't really just go surf it. But I remember in hunting seasons past, how many guys would share trail camera pictures of deer on their property. And the amount of people that actually killed the deer that they had pictures of was pretty small. Again, it's how you use the technology. I think it's a great tool for the right application, the right situation, and the right style if you feel comfortable doing it. But I really respect your opinion because you're an opinionated guy. Let's face it. you have an opinion, but you know, even when I was struggling with some decisions years ago about what I wanted to do, kind of the next phase in my journey, what weapon I wanted to use, you flat out just told me it's your decision. It doesn't matter what anybody thinks. It's not for me to say what's right or wrong for you. And I always did respect that from you and appreciated that.
Well, you know, that's what gets me fired up about social media is, you know, just this week I had some clown ripping on me for sharing my opinion on my page. And I was not trying to force my opinion on anybody else. I've got an opinion and I've got a reason for my opinion, but that doesn't mean I don't respect someone who has a different opinion.
So here's a question that we can both answer. You know, we get ripped all the time. We have a podcast. It's part of being in kind of more of the public eye. People come onto our page and rip us all the time. When was the last time you saw a post from somebody else and uninvited or without someone asking your opinion, you got on somebody else's page or post and absolutely ripped them or challenged them on it? I don't know that I've done it in years. I mean,
it's been a long time. Now, sometimes I'll get on a public page and voice my opinion. And now in years past, I was an internet terrorist. I'll be the first to say it. But as I've matured and mellowed out and aged, you know, I respect people's opinion when it's different than mine. That doesn't mean I'm going to keep my pie hole shut though, because I've got an opinion and I'm basing my opinion usually on years of experience. And, you know, this gray hair didn't just come overnight. I've been on this earth a while, and my opinion just, I didn't develop it last night in bed.
If you listen to many of our podcasts, you know that minimizing human intrusion is the key to our success. Don Higgins and I have been utilizing the Quiet Cat bike for many years now. As shed season is here, turkey season is not far away. There's no better choice to navigate around your property than a Quiet Cat bike. Go visit Quiet Cat and use the word Higgins to get a free trailer with any Quiet Cat electric bike purchase.
Well, I think the second question of the night is going to fall right in line with this. Like you said, you picked two out that are very similar in theme. So why don't we read this one?
The next one comes from Fran Yesh from Burr Oak, Michigan. Fran says, howdy, Don and Terry. Your podcast is terrific. Lots of great info. And Lester's feed helps so many. God bless you for that. My question is on ethics. I have been deer hunting for over 50 years and have seen the changes to all of hunting. Do you feel that raised blinds, outhouses, are ethical? I know people who have set up their outhouses with all the comforts of home. Might as well hunt from the house. Seems like most hunters want the easy way. Gene Wenzel's book in your article, Gene Wenzel's article in your book, Whitetail Icons, touches on this. Great book. Not going to bring up expandable broadheads or crossbows. Thanks for your time and comments and all you do for the hunting community. God bless. Well, friend, just to be honest, I've got 5 outhouses on my farm. And there's just, I could almost just repeat the same comments I had from the last question. You know, there's a lot of things about the good old days that I miss. And there's also some things that have improved. And I'll give you an example. I think, you know, trail cameras have allowed me to expand my hunting season. You know, I can't wait for July 1st every year because that's when I'm getting my trail cameras out. And it's almost as if my deer season starts July 1st instead of October 1st like it used to. Just the fact that so many deer hunters today are getting into to managing their land, to improving the habitat, you know, providing food through food plots or supplemental feeding throughout the entire year. And, you know, not just throwing out a corn pile to draw deer in to shoot them. There's a whole lot of positives that have happened in the 45 years that I've been a deer hunter, but there's a few negatives as well. And, you know, some of the advances in archery equipment, I don't embrace, and I'm not a big fan of, just my opinion. The outhouses, I think that's the first time I've probably ever heard that phrase used.
We might have to keep using that one. That's
yeah, the outhouse. But I'll tell you what, friend, when it's cold out, I would much rather be sitting in a tree stand than a blind. But when it gets zero out, I'm not too proud to tell you I would rather be in a blind on a day like that. They'll break the wind. They're just typically when I go to a blind, it's about 20 degrees warmer in that blind than it is outside. And, you know, when it gets zero with the wind blowing, I'll take that 20 degrees every day.
It sure is not as comfortable when it's hot. I can tell you that because when it's warm, it's not pleasant in those. The positives about an outhouse, as he calls it, is, you know, we take a lot of guest hunters on your property, you know, and more bucks are shot by other people on your farm than obviously you. And to be quite honest with you, when we're trying to tell a story, with a video camera in the tree with us, or we're taking another hunter with us, to be able to kind of control what's going on, make sure the wrong buck isn't shot, spend time with the person, you know, because obviously there's a reason we're taking someone hunting, that gives us a lot more opportunities. Some of the best conversations that you and I have ever had have been in an elevated blind instead of, you know, in a tree. So I think you just have to make the right decision, and everybody's going to say, well, I'm against crossbows, but I'm okay with elevated blinds, but I'm against elevated blinds, but I'm okay with crossbows. Everybody's not always going to agree on the continuation of different blinds, where I think you've said, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, an elevated blind never put a bad hit on a deer. And I think that's where you've drawn the line sometimes is, you know, where you've talked about crossbows or mechanical broadheads, is there's been things that have wounded deer. An elevated blind doesn't do that.
Yeah. And you know, my biggest thing with crossbows is that, the people that are using them, for the most part, they're not in love with the crossbow. They're not in love with archery. They're using it. If they love the crossbow, they would be using it during gun season. You don't see anyone using a crossbow during gun season. They're using it to take advantage of the long archery season and to make the hunt as easy as possible. And I get that to some degree, but you know, we're going to cross a point somewhere down the road where things have become too easy. And I talk about this in the debate with Joe that we're going to hear, you know, shortly. I'm really concerned about the direction of the bow hunting industry. It's all about making it easier, making it faster, shooting farther, just, you know, everybody wants to, yeah. And I feel really sorry for these young guys today. I'm blessed to have grown up when I did, but these young guys, you know, a lot of them, deer hunting to them is an elevated blind with a corn pile in front of it and a cell camera on that corn pile. And they sit there and they monitor their phone. And when they see a buck coming to their corn pile, it's time to go hunting. They climb up in their blind and they're sitting there probably texting on their phone the whole time they're sitting there until the buck shows up and they shoot it. And that's not deer hunting at all to me. To do that, it doesn't require any knowledge of deer behavior. It doesn't require you to be able to read deer sign. And there's almost like a generation that's being lost here due to technology. And, you know, I understand these last two questions, cell cameras. If they were outlawed, it wouldn't bother me one bit. You know, I would get rid of the ones I have. I basically use them for the properties that are farthest from my home anyway. it's not like I'm using them local. Now there's a couple of key spots on my farm, where I'll use them, but, it wouldn't bother me whatsoever to get rid of cell cams. Hunting blinds, if I had to give up one of the two, I'd give up the cell cams way before I would the blinds. Just from the comfort factor, the older I get. But you know, again, ethics, it's not any one person's position or duty or right to tell anyone else what they should be doing. And if what you're doing is legal to a certain degree, you know, who's someone else to tell you that, it's wrong.
Yep.
But with that said, let me build on that just a little bit.
No, I was getting ready to say, I'm not letting you off the hook with in and
it's, if you think about it though, ethics take over where the law ends. So the law is really black and white, and the law allows you to do, you know, everything from here is legal, but everything here is illegal. Do you ever stop and think that what are game laws? Game laws are rules put in place by a bunch of corrupt politicians, most of whom have been bought off by special interest groups. And when someone says, well, it's legal, so it's okay. Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And you know, if you're hunting close to like a state line, I've been on properties and consulting where I was literally walking the state line right along a fence. The other side of the fence is a different state. So this side of the fence, I'm allowed to follow one set of rules, but 3 feet on the other side of the fence, I've got to totally change my perception because this group of corrupt politicians see things different than this group of corrupt politicians, and it's all based on special interest. It really comes down to, you know, our heart, our Christian faith. You know, the Holy Spirit gives us a sense of right and wrong. We know when we're doing something wrong. Now, when the Holy Spirit convicts me, it may be totally different than you. And a lot of that is, you know, our background, where the region we grew up in, you know, our upbringing and the traditions in the areas where we grew up. And so where I'm going with this is it's really a deep subject. And for one person to think that they should be able to dictate what's ethical for the whole, you know, hunting industry or hunting community is just wrong.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest takeaway is everybody's quick to judge and quick to tell somebody they're doing something wrong or they should be doing it different. I think we need a little bit different approach in this community. And I'm not saying just give everybody a pat on the back and a participation trophy either by any means. I think that there's a balance of accountability and holding our brother or sister in the outdoor industry, just like we do, you know, our brothers and sisters in Christ, holding them accountable, but also letting them make the decision that's best for them and their family.
Right. Well said.
I think the one thing that we can agree on that if you look at your career, and I'm going to call it a career in the outdoor industry, whether you want to call it that or not, but you do make your living related to whitetail. So I'm going to call it a career. The one thing I think that we've talked about several times is when, and it's not to say you used to be selfish, but I think one thing that we can both see is that when we really, both of us with our businesses and with our personal lives, focused on trying to help others through what we were doing, is when we became the most successful and we became the most blessed of anything. And I think if people have that mentality and their heart is in that place, these other little things about cell cameras and elevated blinds tend to get a little bit smaller because you're doing it for different reasons. You're doing it to glorify God or help someone else.
That is a fantastic point, Terry. I see it both in my hunting and in business. You know what, since 2017, I've shot 4 of my top 5 bucks. The businesses that I'm involved in have just absolutely exploded in the last 3 years. And the thing that's changed, I've gained a little knowledge in that time, but I don't think it was significant as far as a deer hunter. But I think what's changed the most is my heart. I think that I've become way less selfish.
We've gotten rid of the selfish people in our lives.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. I focus on helping others. I live by that motto. If you want to be blessed, be a blessing. And when you're a blessing, and there's no faking it. Here's the thing about it. There's no faking it. God knows your heart, and you can't, your mouth doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what comes out your mouth. It's what's in your heart, and God knows what's in your heart. And I've seen it firsthand. I'm telling you, I could tell stories on here that would just make some people's heads explode of people that we've dealt with and that have had, and I'm talking on both sides of the spectrum, people who had, I don't even know what the term I should use, but a corrupted heart, maybe an unpure heart, whose motives weren't pure. And then we've seen great people that we've worked with who's got hearts of gold, and without a doubt, and we're seeing it across this country today in different businesses and industries, those people, those Christian businesses that truly, truly follow what they believe, that they help others. I'm telling you, I can't even begin to name all the companies that I've seen that are truly blessed because they're helping others. And we've seen it with our own business.
Yep. So with that, why don't we take a quick break and talk about Lester's Feet for a little bit?
The Lester's Feet Foundation is a 100% volunteer, nonprofit organization whose sole mission is to help families with sick children. The impact on families who have children with life-altering illnesses can be devastating and often requires one or both parents to be away from work. Through our fundraising efforts and the help of our generous donors, Lester's Feet works with families to help alleviate the financial burdens associated with caring for their children through such a challenging time. 100% of donations and fundraising profits go directly to the families we are supporting. We are excited to announce that Solid Rock Chapel in Sullivan, Illinois, is supporting our foundation by hosting a huge raffle with $150,000 worth of prizes, including a new Chevy truck, a John Deere tractor, a material kit to a post-frame building, and much more. The drawing will be on July 4th, 2022, so please visit us at www.lestersfeetfoundation.org to purchase your raffle tickets and learn more about our organization.
All right, Don. Well, the topic in the title of this episode is coming up, and that's your debate with Joe Miles about mechanical broadheads. You've said from the very beginning that they should be outlawed. While this was more of a, I think Joe called it a gentleman's conversation, or and not really debate. It's still fun to get a chance to talk with him a little bit.
Yeah, it is, and we recorded that just a little bit ago before we recorded the rest of the podcast. We kind of did it different, so you and I already know how the debate went, but hopefully the folks will enjoy it, and we may not change a single person's mind, either one of us. That's fine. Joe's a guy that I respect a lot. He's killed way more deer than I have. He's probably killed more game animals in the last 3 years than I have in my life.
He said a number and I thought, holy cow. But I mean, he's traveled all over the world.
And just this week he was in Texas, and what, he shoot an axis buck or something in Texas. Yep. I mean, I'm happy if I kill one buck a year, and on a really good year, I might shoot two. This guy will kill two in a week, and he's all over the planet doing it. So just a great guy. And it was a privilege to have him on.
Yeah, and the funny thing was, we kind of joked about the liberals at the beginning, but the thing we didn't touch on is we do share a very common piece of equipment between the three of us, and Joe is also a longtime Matthews shooter. So even though what's on the tip of the arrow is a little bit different, the company that we both work with, because of the technology, because of the performance, but most of all the people behind the company, is Matthews. So I guess we should have brought that up during the debate.
We should have. That's a perfect example. Matthews is a perfect example of what I was just talking about. God knows the heart of those people at Matthews. And that company is absolutely blessed because of it.
Yep. All right. Well, we're going to play the video of the debate. We hope you enjoy it. Stay tuned. Well, welcome everyone to the Chasing Giants. And Joe Miles, you want to introduce your podcast for all the listeners? Because I think this debate that we're getting ready to talk about is going to actually probably be aired on both podcasts simultaneously. So before we get kicking off, just plug your podcast real quick.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much. The name of our podcast is Mission Whitetail, and it's all whitetail information, and we're excited about it. We're getting into our fourth and fifth episode, and thank you all so much.
So this has been talked about for almost a month and a half now, that you two are going head-to-head to debate Don's radical opinion and statements of that expandable broadhead should be outlawed. And we've talked about having a debate with somebody for a long time. I find it so ironic that the primary sponsor of our podcast is the one that's actually going to step up and do this with us. But it's going to be a real informal debate at the end of the day. I don't think either one of you are going to change the other one's minds. But it's going to be a lot of information and insight from both perspectives that I think people can make their decision that's best for them. So we're going to lay out kind of a format of how this debate was going to go. And I thought it would be best for the liberal on the call to get first chance at claiming their opinion. Because, you know, the liberals are always out front with their hand out wanting to go first and get everything. So who's going first?
I guess you must have described Joe, because you're not talking about me.
Yes, I think we've gotten our wires crossed somehow here, Terry. We might have to do this intro over.
So just for clarification, there's no liberals on the call. So
I hope not.
Yeah, roger that. No, we are definitely we could definitely attack together on that front. I guarantee. So
that topic you would be aligned on, but
100%. No doubt about it.
But for the purpose of this, we think it's probably best. Don's been the most outspoken about this topic. As I mentioned just a little bit ago, he's gone on record at public appearances on the podcast, articles that to quote Don saying that mechanical broadheads should be outlawed. So I'm going to give Don maybe 3 to 4 minutes. If you even need that long,
I need at least that.
Hopefully, let's try to keep the opening comments under 5 minutes. And then, Joe, I'll give you the floor for 5 minutes, and then we'll take off from there. But yeah, let's just go on. And I'm sure Don's got something to say more than just garbage.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to thank Joe for taking part of this debate. Like Terry said, I've been wanting to do this debate with somebody for a long time, but I never thought in a million years that the title sponsor of the podcast would be the guy that steps up to do it. I want to thank you, Joe, for stepping up and taking part. I also want to say that to everyone listening that I support a person's right to choose. This is a free country. You know, America was built on freedoms, and I've said it before, I've had people hunt on my farm in the same blind with me using a mechanical broadhead, and I never said a word to them about it. I never tried to belittle them in any way. I support their right to shoot whatever they want. But with that said, I do believe mechanical should be outlawed, and the reason for it is twofold. My opposition to mechanicals is based on an ethical factor, in my opinion. I just believe that there's more game wounded with a mechanical head than with a traditional cut on impact broadhead. So I think as bow hunters, we should be trying to make the quickest, most ethical, clean kill that we possibly can. And if an animal is hit correctly, there is no doubt in my mind that a mechanical will do a fine job. It's those instances where we don't hit that animal exactly where we want that I think a traditional cut on impact broadhead will offer better penetration. I've said many times that I would rather see have a 1-inch hole all the way through a deer than a 2-inch hole halfway through. I think that exit hole is very important for the blood trail, but you just hit so many more vital organs when you go all the way through a deer instead of partway through. So, you know, from the animal's perspective, again, we just need to make it quick and clean when we shoot an animal. From the hunter's perspective, I don't want to ever see a bow hunter lose an animal. You know, no matter what they're shooting, traditional equipment, compound, crossbow, expandable, cut on impact, it doesn't matter. I want to see every bow hunter recover every animal that he shoots. And I'm sure Joe feels the same way. I just feel that a cut on impact broadhead will do a better job. I think an expandable broadhead or a mechanical broadhead is a chance that we just don't need to take. It's a chance for failure that is not there with the cut on impact or the cut on contact.
Is that it?
That's it for now.
You only used up 4 minutes and didn't use the word garbage once. Yeah, that was a good opening comment. I think at this point, Joe, you know, we're not really into debating here yet, but, I guess your opening comments based on, Don's comments.
Yeah. Okay. So first and foremost, you know, thank y'all so much for having me, Don. I appreciate it. And, you know, there's not a guy that I could think of that I respect more in the hunting industry than Don Higgins. The integrity, the loyalty, just and your passion for the same thing I love to do, you know, hunting big white-tailed deer is, you know, I know that you would never use an inferior product or something that you thought was not going to give you the best chance of killing a big deer. I don't care how much money somebody paid you, you're not going to shoot something that you don't think is going to give you the absolute best chance. And there have been a lot of big deer killed with fixed blade, cut on contact heads, and there have been a lot of big deer killed with mechanical heads. There's two things for me, really, that I consider here. They're facts, you know, things that really aren't debatable. And then there's the percent chances of something going wrong. You know, those are the two things that I look at. And the reason I've shot, I mean, just in the last 2 years, 29 animals. That's Africa, that's whitetail, you know, and I've tested about every possible broadhead that you can test. And I've killed a bunch of animals with fixed blade heads. I've killed them with the cut on contact, with the with mechanicals. And what I have determined as fact is that a well-built cut on contact fixed blade broadhead is going to penetrate better than a well-built mechanical. I've tested it, I've seen it, and that is a fact. Now, what I have also tested is that a mechanical broadhead is going to be quieter, it's more accurate, and it has a bigger cut. Those are all facts. I've tested them with decibel readers, and it's a smaller profile going through the air, so it is a quieter broadhead. It has a larger cutting diameter, which is important, and it's more accurate. Accuracy is more important to me than penetration. With modern equipment, you know, if we get into, you know, less poundage bows where penetration becomes, you know, you're shooting 40 or 50 pounds and penetration becomes an issue, then yes, I can see, and I would recommend a cut on contact, but with modern equipment, it you know, decent heavy weight, you know, 60 pound plus bows, I see the advantage with being quieter, more accurate, and having a larger cutting diameter. And the penetration has never ever been an issue for me. The only place that I can see penetration being an issue is in the actual leg bone. But as far as scapulas, the Rage Tripan is the head that I've tested. They're not all made the same. I'll say that too. Mechanicals are not all made the same. The Tripan and all of my testing has been proven time and time again to penetrate through scout. I mean, I've got videos on my YouTube channel. I just shot an Axis deer 2 days ago in Texas, and I can show pictures of that blew through the scapula and out the other side of the leg with a big 2.5-inch cut on one side and 2-inch on the other. So I guess that's my thing, is that I am super open-minded when it comes to this. And if a broadhead comes out, or if I have failure, I will switch, because like Don, I want what's going to give me the greatest advantage, because you don't get many opportunities at these big deer, and I have to be able to kill them. And, you know, Terry, I guess that's kind of my opening statement. And then we can get into more about shot placement and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's great opening comments. For those of you seeing that my camera shuts off, I want Don and Joe to be filling out the screen on this. I'm just the innocent bystander that kind of tees up some questions and dialogue. But I think you two just need to dive in. Before I ask some questions, I think you two just need to dive in another round on that, because I think probably some wheels are spinning from both of your sides right now. So Don, just second round of comments in general.
Well, I think as I listen to Joe, I have no doubt that he truly believes everything he's saying. And there's really nothing that he said that I can argue with. I think a big difference in the two of us is I'm old school. And, you know, I'm trying to get those deer into 20 yards and less. And some of the you know, issues that he mentioned, such as noise with the broadhead, and better flight, is not an issue for me at 20 yards. And I think Joe's probably shooting farther than me. I mean, I've said it before that I am not a great archery shot. Now, if I get a deer within 30 yards, he's pretty much dead. Don't get me wrong. I'm not, you know, just flinging arrows and with a hope and a prayer, hoping I stick one in him. But I'm not shooting, you know, past 30 yards. I've never shot a whitetail, period, past 35. The farthest one I ever shot was 35, and that was probably close to 40 years ago. So I think some of our difference in opinion probably comes from our equipment. I'm a heavy arrow guy. I want that arrow to go all the way through. But you know what? It really comes down to me is, you know, to kind of prove my point, there are certain states out west where expandables or mechanicals are not allowed. They're illegal on certain game. I know there's African outfitters that won't allow expandable heads, and even some outfitters, even whitetail outfitters, there's some of those that will not allow the mechanical heads. And I think it all comes down to, it's a chance that doesn't need to be taken. Again, if you hit the animal right, it doesn't matter what's on the end of your arrow, you're going to kill it. But it's those shots that don't hit exactly where we want, that's when I want to maximize my chances of recovering that animal. And, you know, I've shot more than one big old whitetail buck right through the shoulder blade. And I recall hearing sounds that sounded like somebody took a Louisville Slugger baseball bat and just broke it over their knee when that arrow hit that shoulder blade. And I think, oh my gosh, I'm never going to find that when I just hit him in the shoulder. But in the two times in my career that's happened, both bucks went less than 70 yards. And I got enough penetration to got into the chest. You know, there's a guy not far from me that has a bloodhound, does a lot of tracking, and he'll tell you that there's way more issues with mechanical heads in his experience than with the fixed blade broadheads. So, you know, that's kind of my stand. When I take a shot, if I don't hit that deer exactly where I wanted to, I want to increase my odds of recovery.
Okay, good comments. Joe, why don't you respond with however you want on that?
Yep, I very good points. All of those are very good points. I think that you know, shooting animals is a game of inches. And like Don, I agree. I want to maximize my chances of killing that deer as quickly as possible. You have a much greater chance of running an arrow through a deer's guts than you do hitting the leg bone. I've proven it a million times, not a million, I've proven it a bunch that a well-built mechanical head will go through shoulder blades all the way through them. I've shot lots of animals in Africa, big 350-pound Nyala bulls right through both shoulder blades. And again, if I run a 2-inch cut through a whitetail's guts, or I run a this isn't going to be featured on any liberal shows, so saying guts, I think, is okay. So it's through a whitetail's guts, I'm going to have a much greater time, chance of recovering that deer having a 2-inch cut through the guts, because there's going to be a blood trail. And I've shot deer with 1/8-inch fixed blade heads and not recovered them. And I saw the arrow go through the guts, pick the arrow up, and guts all over the arrow. A 2-inch cut through the guts with a Rage tripan is going to give me a better chance of recovering a deer. And that's not, I have a greater chance of hitting the guts than I do the leg bone. And I think the reason that mechanicals are outlawed in certain states and some outfitters in Africa, you know, I guided in Africa for 7 years and have shot a lot of animals with fixed and mechanical broadheads over there, is because I will never debate that the original mechanical broadheads were horrible. The original Rage that came out, I think the first one ever was a Jackhammer, and they were pieces of junk. But the technology has really improved, and you know, there's a Sever broadhead out now that's really good. There's a G5 mechanical that's really good, well built, and then that Rage tripan, who I am not sponsored by or paid or anything like that. Those are real. The technology in those broadheads are incredible. And I think you have to define failure. And I don't want to put words in Don's mouth here, but I would say Don will say, well, the mechanical, you know, if it hits a shoulder blade or a leg bone, the broadhead can break, it can open in flight. You know, there's chances that it won't penetrate enough, and those are failures. And you know, I would agree with that, that there is a chance those things can happen. But then I look at it the other way around, is how can a fixed blade fail? And the way a fixed blade can fail, this is going to get a little bit technical, but if it is making a louder noise going through the air and the deer reacts more to that broadhead making a noise, which they do react to that, and it causes him to duck only an inch more, you know, that's in my mind, a failure, because I get there, you know, an inch, I save an inch. You know, if I'm able to be more accurate and hit where I'm aiming, you know, I'm going there. There's a reason why tournament archers shoot field points. They don't shoot fixed blade broadheads. They shoot a low profile head because it's much more accurate. And to me, accuracy trumps penetration. And I've had no issues with penetration with the mechanicals that I shoot. And then, you know, another failure for a fixed blade head would be if you run one through the guts and you don't recover the animal because the hole's not big enough. And I have an advantage with a mechanical going through the guts, which I've already said it is a much larger target, and you're much more likely to hit the guts than you are the actual leg bone. And quite frankly, looking at the anatomy of a deer, a leg bone shot is only a small percent of where that would be actually vital. So that would be kind of my reply there.
Okay. I don't have an opinion in this conversation. This is a debate between you, but so I did not create the questions, but I did ask a couple guys that I'm friends with, or that I know, that I do not know and still do not know what broadhead they shoot. I couldn't tell you what these guys shoot. I told them not to tell me, but I explained what we were doing today. And, one of the guys, asked me a question, and it created a little bit of dialogue, and I'm going to use a softball term for you guys to set up the question. You guys know I coach fast pitch softball at the high school level, And there's this saying that a $500 bat does not fix a $5 swing. What that means is, you know, all these softball moms will go out and buy a $500 bat and give to their kid, thinking that it's going to help them hit the ball out of the ballpark. And in all reality, the higher end bats actually have less of a sweet spot where the ball will jump off of it than some of the cheaper bats, which means when you hit it pure and you hit it perfect, those high end bats will do a better job. So putting that kind of into context in relationship to the archery industry or the outdoor community, you know, we put guys like you two who are passionate. They spend a lot of time at their craft, but at the same time, amateurs who are just getting into the sport are looking at both of you to help make their decision. So if someone buys their first bow and they don't know anything about arrow weight, spline of arrows, they don't know anything about how to set up a proper shooting scenario or with their piece of equipment, does one type broadhead lend themselves to an advantage? Because you guys are focusing on, you guys are dialed in. You know exactly the ins and outs of everything, but we have a lot of people looking at you for advice. So I'm going to start with Joe on this one. Joe, if somebody comes up to you and they don't know anything about getting started in archery, does one broadhead give an advantage over the other for the complete novice?
The complete novice, the first thing I would do was figure out what weight they're shooting. You know, if they're shooting 60 pounds plus, even 55 pounds plus, I'm going to get them on a moderately weighted arrow, and I'm going to get them with a Rage Tri-Pan broadhead. I mean, that's the setup that I would recommend for a guy, because in my opinion, he has a greater chance of being successful because you don't have to be as accurate. We talk about, when I say that you don't have to be as accurate, you're going to be more accurate with a mechanical broadhead than you are with a fixed blade. And it's going to give you more room. You know, I would argue the opposite of what Don says, or actually the same thing Don says, is it gives me more room for error because the guts, liver, and the back of that animal is such a larger target to hit. And I'm going to do way better in recovery if I've got a 2-inch cut through that part of the animal. So that would be my setup for the novice, for the first time guy.
Don?
Well, ironically, I think it's the novice who gives the mechanical broadhead the bad name at most, if you will, because the novice typically is going to take poorer shots. They're not going to see as many deer while they're hunting. And so when they do see a deer, it's like, oh my gosh, I better take a shot because this might be the only shot I get, you know, all season. And so the novice has got, they're taking steep quartering shots, either quartering two or steep quartering away. And that's where the mechanical is more prone to failure. If I was guiding a novice hunter, I'd be coaching them to limit their shots to 20 yards. First of all, I would be more focused on shot selection than I would be equipment selection. Now, with that said, I would make sure that they could shoot their equipment efficiently, you know, at whatever range we were going to limit them to. But I think the novice is the one that's going to have the most issues with a mechanical head.
Okay. So to piggyback on that question, I'm going to start with Don this time. Another gentleman, this is a great segue. His question was, is a mechanical broadhead just an easy fix for someone who doesn't know how to tune an arrow? Basically meaning if I don't know how to, or if, good way to put it, if I don't have time to invest all the, you know, 100 shots a day or whatever, is that a good opportunity or reason to go with mechanical because I don't have to tune that fixed blade broadhead as much?
Well, I don't know if it's a good reason, but it's certainly a reason that I hear a lot of people mention. Again, I think, most people are going to use a broadhead that was promoted to them by someone that they look up to, whether it be their local archery pro shop, a guy like Joe or myself. you know, if they listen to Joe's podcast on a regular basis, they're probably going to be a lot more inclined to shoot a mechanical broadhead than if they listen to Chasing Giants, my podcast. I think that veteran hunters, I don't think we realize the impact that we can have on a novice. And it goes way beyond the selection of broadhead. It's shot selection. It's how far you're going to shoot. I'm old school. I've said it, many times that I'm for getting that deer close. I started hunting with a recurve 40 some years ago and stuck with a recurve for a long time. I remember when releases come out, I was one of the last guys that I knew, last bow hunters I knew to give up shooting with bare fingers and use a release. And I'm telling you, a release is way more accurate. I can tell you that today. When carbon arrows first came out, I remember we was all using aluminum arrows and we went to carbon, and those carbon arrows were about the size of a, they weren't even hardly as big as a drinking straw, little bitty arrows. And, I fought that when it came out. I remember when the overdraw came out, where so you could shoot shorter arrows and have flatter trajectory because of your shorter arrow. And I never have shot a single arrow out of that. I'm old school. I don't embrace change unless it's proven beneficial. Terry's laughing because he knows how true that is. And, just as I never embraced the overdraw, which today is no longer, you can't find one today. Well, I'm hoping the day comes where we can no longer find an expandable broadhead on the market too.
So, Joe, what do you think about that comment or that question from?
So the question, just let me recap. So the question is, guys use mechanicals because they can't tune their fixed blades. They don't have time or whatever. Okay. So that's a really good question. And I do hear that a good bit. Guys will say, I can tune my fixed blade heads to shoot fine. And that goes back to an accuracy thing, right? The mechanical is going to be more accurate with a tuned or untuned bow. You take somebody that shoots a mechanical broadhead, really understands tuning, and they get them dialed in their backyard, and they are super accurate 30, 40, 50 yards. And I see it with a fixed blade head, right? They're super accurate. Their bow is very well tuned. So, but that's in the backyard. Everybody knows that hunting situations are completely different. You get into shot situations where you have to bend around trees and torque your bow in the real world. And when you torque your bow, you take it out of tune. And when that bow is out of tune and you've torqued it because you got to make a shot under a branch or over a branch or around a tree.
In a love swing,
absolutely right. You're distracting me on purpose, Terry. when you do that, your fixed blade head is not going to be as accurate. Whereas when you torque a bow with a mechanical head, it's still going to maintain a lot of its accuracy. And then you get into wind. Wind is going to push a fixed blade head a lot more than it's going to push a mechanical. So it goes back to accuracy. And yes, a guy can tune a fixed blade head to shoot true. But in hunting situations, if you have to torque your bow out of the love swing or out of any stand for that matter, you're going to not be as accurate. So yes, I don't know if that answers it exactly right, but that
there's no wrong answers, but the people that are watching this are going to think that we did a really good job organizing, but you guys just keep teeing up the next question that I'm going to start with Joe on this one is, you both are very concerned about the ethics inside of our sport and wanting to do the right thing for the animal, whether that's DNR's laws, regulations, equipment that we use. I got a question out of left field that I was not expecting. And it kind of ties into a lot of the crossbow technology where, companies are advertising you can shoot a crossbow at 100 yards. Is building on the accuracy of a fixed head promoting the outdoor community to be able to take shots further than they should, or what their skill set is, or what is ethical for a deer? So we talked about, wind, we talked about accuracy. does that lead people to believe that they should be taking shots further than what they should be?
Oh, I'm sure that it does. I'm sure that it does lean guys to shoot further than they should. But I think shots are there's so much that goes into that, right? It's the condition of the deer. It's the situation of where the deer is located, the posture. One guy may shoot way better than me. I might shoot better than Don. Don might shoot better than me. You know, there's so many factors there. But yes, I think especially with crossbows, that there is a sense of being able to reach out and touch them further than you actually can, because it's a moving target. The deer has a say. You know, it's ducking, trying to get out of the way. And I don't take insanely long shots either. I've just seen, you know, you shoot over the back of them a few times and you realize that, you know, what your effective range is and quite frankly, what the effective range is of the equipment that you're using.
Don?
Well, again, I'm old school and I see these changes coming through the archery industry or that have come through the archery industry over the last 45 years. And it concerns me that when I started, archery was a close range sport. It wasn't meant for everyone. It took dedication to kill a deer with archery equipment. I remember when the compound bow came out about the time I was in high school, you know, these crazy looking bows with wheels on the ends of them, pulleys, whatever you want to call them, come out. And I just think that bow hunting is going in a direction that's not good for the sport and a perfect example is here in the state of Illinois, the archery harvest now rivals the gun harvest. And at one time it was just a small fraction of the total harvest. Today, the archery harvest is 50%. The firearm harvest is 50%. And a lot of that is due to the advancement in the equipment. And, you know, we can blame it on the crossbow, but it's not just the crossbow. It's everything on top of each other. And at some point, we're going to pay for it as bow hunters, and we're going to pay for it with shortened seasons. And there's already talk of that in my home state of Illinois right now that, you know, our archery, our bow hunting in Illinois was like a luxury. The management of the deer herd was based around the gun season because that's where the majority of the harvest took place. That's all changing. We can't continue for the archery harvest to climb as a higher percentage and think that we're going to keep these long seasons. So the expandable broadhead, I just think, is part of that because that is part of a setup that allows people to shoot longer distances than we could say 25, 30, 40 years ago. Another thing that concerns me with the whole bow hunting industry community, if you will, is a lack of role models, a lack of guys that are willing to stand up and go against the grain at times. And that doesn't mean that we've got to, you know, be disrespectful to the person that has the opposing view. But we need to give new bow hunters both sides of a topic. And that's what Joe and I are doing here. I have absolutely as much respect for Joe as I do any bow hunter on the planet. I don't care if they're using a long bow and a arrow they whittled out of a stick. It's not what a man carries in his hand or a bow hunter carries in his hand that's so important. It's what he carries in his heart. And, you know, Joe is a passionate bow hunter just the same as I do. And just because we've got a different instrument screwed on the end of our arrow doesn't make one of us better or worse than the other. But the whole archery industry, bow hunting industry, if you will, as a whole, I just don't like the path it's going down as far as advances in equipment.
Okay. All right. Well, I have one more question. People are going to think it's a little baiting to one side or the other, and I promise it's not. It was the last question that I got that was given to me. And I guess tied into this question that I'll start with Joe on, I think are we back to Joe starting out? No, you did this one. We'll start with Don. I guess kind of give your wrap up comment with the answer to this question. And then I'll close it out with just a couple comments to end it. If that's all right. You know, everybody that gets in this debate has a personal preference. Whether they got that from a influencer, where they got that from a recommendation or through past experience, success or failure. The question that was asked point blank to me is, there's no way we can truly quantify this with statistical data, but what does your gut tell you if you look at, if you were to look at your gut feeling for a statistical analysis of every shot that was taken by a bow hunter in a single season? That's amateurs all the way up to guys like you. Which one has the best recovery rate, Don?
Well, my
gut
guess
feeling,
would be,
gut feeling, there's no way we can quantify this, but gut feeling.
Fixed blade. I just hear way too many horror stories. And, you know, since I've got on my Rampage, I've literally had hundreds of bow hunters share stories, horror stories, that they've experienced with mechanical broadheads over the years. So without a doubt, I think the mechanical is the biggest failure, or percentage wise fails more than a fixed blade.
Joe?
Yeah. Okay. So I think there have been some studies on this out there. I can't remember exactly where it was, but I think it was a big public ground piece somewhere that they started keeping records of that. And that at the beginning of keeping the records, the fixed blade head definitely outperformed the mechanical, but as technology has improved, the mechanical has caught up and maybe even surpassed. I don't know that to be fact, but I do know there are some studies out there. I would probably have to lean towards Don on this and agree with him. And the reason for that is because guys don't test their equipment. They will go buy any junky piece of junk, because I'm not going to use profanity, mechanical.
And garbage. The word garbage.
Garbage. Yeah, they will get a garbage mechanical head that is front deploying, and they are garbage. You're not going to find a well-built, cut-on-contact fixed blade head that is garbage. Those are solid heads, and they do their job. But if guys would shoot the Rage Tripan, and again, I'm not sponsored by them or anything, it's just what I've tested. If they would shoot a Sever or a Rage Tripan, I really, in my gut, think that the recovery rate would be higher with those type broadheads, simply because the liver, the guts, it's just a much bigger target on the animal. And I think if that was the case, if it was apples to apples with the high-end fixed blade head versus the high-end mechanical head, you would have more recovery with the mechanical head.
Okay. Just a couple thoughts from my side. I think to summarize what Don's always kind of said, but not very short and sweet, he's kind of said a couple times it's just a variable or a risk you don't have to take, or it's a factor you don't have to put into play. Joe's comments are, if you're using the right equipment the right way and know your limits, it could be a better tool. Almost like that softball analogy. It is a hotter bat, but you got to hit it in the sweet spot versus have a bad swing. So, again, I don't think either one of you are wrong. You both are using what you both feel confident is the best choice in your arsenal. But it is a very different perspective from people. And again, I think the disconnect in the outdoor community is that we always look at the guys who fight so hard for one thing are the guys that are shooting either a whole bunch or have done it for a really long time one way, like Don's against change. I remember years ago, and I hope I don't get hate mail from him for saying this, because I remember as a young hunter, me watching, I don't know if it was Real Tree Road Trips or one of the Monster Buck, and Waddell was in a tree out in Kansas, one of these 30, 40 mile an hour winds, and he pulls back on a buck at like 60 yards and just puts it in the tin ring. I mean, unbelievable shot. And I thought, wow, you know, his equipment is dialed in. I got to go do that. And the first thing I thought I could do was go out and shoot 60 yards in my yard, not even a tree stand, not even with any wind. And I just don't think people put into perspective, whether you agree with that shot should have been taken or not, probably how much work he put in to feel confident in that shot. And I think what's missing in the outdoor community is the work that both of you do to put into your craft to get that level of confidence versus just take someone else's word for it as what you should do. Whether it's working with your habitat, like you talk about with your masterclass students, Don, and getting that deer within 20 yards so it shouldn't matter, or Joe shooting, I can tell you, I know you shoot a whole lot more than Don because he doesn't shoot a lot. Both of you are very passionate and committed to your craft, which is what gives you that confidence versus watching what an influencer does on and saying, like I did back when I saw Waddell do that, and thinking, oh, well, I can go out and do that in my yard. There's a big disconnect there.
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yep.
So if you guys got anything else to say, have at it. We're going to sign off here and then listen to the rest of both of our podcasts. Both sponsored by Osseo Gear.
No, guys. Well. I thank y'all so much for having me on. I'm humbled to be included in this, Don. It means a lot that you would value my opinion enough to have me on to discuss this. And I think it was more of a gentleman discussion than a real debate. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Joe. And I don't think you and I are ever going to agree on broadheads, but one thing we are going to agree on: Osseo camo, brother.
Yes, sir. That's for sure.
And that nobody on this call is a liberal. We got two things.
Yep. That's right.
That's
the passion to hunt these big deer and the passion to really hunt these big deer. That's for us. You know, if we can help guys be more successful there, you know, that means a lot to me.
All right. Well, I don't know if we changed anybody's mind, made somebody mad, lost followers. I think if Joe loses followers, we'll gain them. If we lose followers, Joe will gain them.
Yeah, work out.
We know that you're old school. That's one takeaway. I never would have dreamed that until that debate.
I think you pretty much had a handle on that. But, you know, the funny thing is I got to thinking about it as I was in that with Joe while it was going on and being recorded. And I got to thinking about the debate I had with Tony LaPratt. Well, I'm doing all these debates with people I like. How would I act if there was somebody that I really didn't care for?
Yeah.
It might be a challenge for me to keep my cool.
Yep. Yeah, but it was a fun time. We always appreciate Joe being on the podcast. And like I said, he's definitely got the shots under his belt and the animals on his wall to have confidence in whatever setup he has, just like you have confidence in yours. So, again, I really think most of it boils down to people need experience and people need a little bit more passion in what they have confidence in versus just listening to some Joe Blow. And somebody that's paid to represent something. I think it goes a little bit beyond that. So, you got a special announcement that we want to talk about before we close out today.
Yeah. You know, we've got a lot of loyal listeners out there, Terry, but there's one gentleman that I know that's having a birthday, today, May 8th. It's not today, but it's the day this is going to be released. And that's Jeremy Skinner. Jeremy, happy birthday, buddy. I heard a report that you and your family listen to the podcast every Sunday evening, your wife and your three kids, and you guys just sit around and you wait. You just keep checking the computer, waiting for the podcast to come on so you guys can sit and listen to it. And I just appreciate your support and hope you have a happy 50th.
Well, Jeremy, I sincerely apologize for the weeks that I don't get it uploaded till 11 o'clock. I keep your kids up probably too late. So for your birthday present this week, we're going to air it a little bit earlier on Mother's Day.
Well, happy birthday, Jeremy.
Happy birthday. And we didn't take much time to talk about this, but Mother's Day is very special. The women in our lives, not only our moms, our grandmas, but also our wives, the mothers to our kids, have been such an important, vital role in everything that we do. If people only knew a fraction of what my wife puts up with for me, The amount of time she volunteers at not only the school, but our church and Lester's Feet. She's the accountant in the family, and she keeps everything on task, just like in many ways your wife Robin does.
Oh, absolutely.
We'd be lost in a lot of ways. So please enjoy this day for the mothers out there.
Do you have any stories you remember from your childhood, Terry, about your mom and the outdoors, related to the outdoors?
Well, you know, my mom is the daughter of Lester Schickle, who Lester's Feet is named after. And Lester was the only person in our family that hunted. So my mom grew up in a hunting household. You know, her dad and her older brothers all hunted. My dad's side of the family didn't hunt. And, you know, mom never participated in any of it. But I think there's a lot of similarities in my parents and your parents is anything that I was passionate about, they did everything they could to try to help me with that. My dad was a minister, and we didn't make hardly any money growing up. But they spent their whole life serving their family and serving the church. And as a young person, I resented it because I always thought the church got more of a priority than we did as kids. But it really, as I got older and understood the where their passion was in serving the Lord, kind of set the precedence for everything else. And that is, you got to have your priorities in order. So they encouraged me to do whatever I wanted with hunting or sports or anything like that. But the biggest thing that both of my parents did was their trust and their faith, and making sure that us kids understood that. And that's probably what I value more than anything as it relates to the outdoors. How about you?
Yeah, I remember back as a young kid, I've appreciated my mom way before I did my dad, because my mom was a stay-at-home mom, and you know, I'd get out home, come home from school, and there she was. I'd get up to go to school, and there she was, where my dad was gone to work. And it wasn't until I was out of the house, had a job of my own, and realized all the sacrifice my dad made. But my mom, you know, I appreciated her from the beginning. And I remember, you know, as a kid, before I was old enough to drive, many, many times my mom would take me and drop me off somewhere to go hunting, or I'd be in the car. She'd be taking me around at a dozen different stops to check traps, and she'd let me out, and I'd run and check my traps at this spot, get back in the car, and she'd drive to the next spot, and I'd get out.
She'd let you bring those stinky animals back into the car.
Oh. We had our freezer at our house just full of dead raccoons and possums and muskrats and mink and everything else. Sometimes you'd have to dig through the dead animals to get the evening supper out. but my mom was always there, and a big reason, you know, that I've been able to accomplish what I have. And I mean, both my parents really, but I mentioned my dad a lot more than I do my mom, but I think it's just because I can relate to my dad as a man myself. But I remember as a little kid, just realizing how fortunate I was to have the mother I had, because, you know, I would compare her to my friends' mothers, and there wasn't a friend I had whose mother was running them around the countryside to check traps or go hunting. And a lot of times my friends would be with me. We'd go hunting, two or three of us together, and we'd just start walking. We lived in a real small town of a couple hundred people. And we would just start walking from town. And back then there was a lot more cover. There was fence rows and hedgerows and creeks and stuff. And you could just continue walking forever hunting. And, you know, we'd start out on a Saturday morning, and by Saturday evening, who knows, we might end up 7-8 miles from town. And we'd just go to a farmhouse and call for a ride home. Well, guess what? Every time we called, we was calling my mom. My mom was the only one that would come and get us. Everybody else's mom would say, hey, you walked out there, walk home. Don't matter if you get home at midnight. But, you know, my mom was always there to support everything my brother and I did. And then even today, you know, she's always asking, do I have any new articles out in the magazine? She reads every article that's ever published. And I've been extremely blessed, as have you, to still to this day have a fantastic mother.
Yep. So happy Mother's Day to all the ladies out there that help us raise those kids. Cause if they're anything like I was when I was a little one, you women are a blessing. So with that, happy Mother's Day, everyone.
Yep. God bless. Happy Mother's Day.
Chasing Giants has been brought to you by Osseo Camo, Bia Farm Real Estate Company, 360 Hunting Blinds, Victory Chevrolet, Real World Wildlife Products, Matthews Archery, Novix Tree Stands, Gingerich Tree Farm, WildlifeFarming.com, Quiet Cat, and Vortex Optics. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for another episode of Chasing Giants.